Welcome to the Together PDX podcast. You're listening to our Gospel Gathering series, where we will be replaying valuable content from past events where local Portland leaders gathered to hear from authors, theologians, and scholars. We'd like to note that the views shared by our guests don't necessarily reflect those of the entire Together PDX team. We pray today's content enriches your day and spirit. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Together PDX podcast. In this episode, we are going to continue with the December 2024 Gospel Gathering on The Pastor, Embracing the Call to Hopeful Endurance with Dr. Scott McKnight. Scott is a world-renowned speaker, writer, professor, and equipper of the church. He's a recognized authority on the historical Jesus, early Christianity, and the New Testament. His books have been translated into Chinese, Korean, Russian, and Portuguese. With his PhD from University of Nottingham, he is the author of The Jesus Creed, The Blue Parakeet, The King Jesus Gospel, Revelation for the Rest of Us, numerous commentaries, and a 14-volume series of reflections called The Everyday Bible Study. In this talk, we get a glimpse into Scott's forthcoming work on trauma and nurturing trauma-safe spaces in the church. This is material he's still working on publishing in a book form, so it is an honor to get to hear it firsthand, and I know it deeply impacted many of the pastors in the room. Without further ado, this is Trauma and the Pastor, Part 1, with Dr. Scott McKnight.
Amy's talk was blameless, right? This won't be. I'm working on a book. Yesterday, we heard from the publisher that they've accepted it. And so I'm entering a new phase. We're going to be writing about trauma. I'm writing about trauma with a trauma therapist on nurturing trauma-sensitive spaces in Christian institutions and churches. Her name is Adrienne Gibson. And trauma is a very, very serious issue in the church. Far more serious than I think many of us realize. And in this talk and in the talk after lunch, if you come back, it's a discount if you come back that I have no right to say. I will continue that talk. So it's a two-part talk about trauma. And you and I are in endless election cycles that divide our nation and divide our churches. And most of you experience divided churches and turbulence over elections. And people want to know where you stand. And during COVID, they were particularly irritated by you because of where you stood or didn't stand. And it was difficult. It was difficult for pastors in ways that safe professors do not sense. We just went on Zoom. It was so easy. And I didn't have to travel and speak. I got to stay home and write, which was like being on sabbatical. And it's not even kind to say that because I know what your experiences were during that time, but it was true. We are experiencing stories of abuse in our churches today. Power abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. And these things cause trauma in people in churches. Trauma of both laity and leaders. And I've written with my daughter two books, A Church Called Tove and Pivot. If you haven't noticed that Pivot, the last three letters are Tove backwards. Very clever. And I had nothing to do with it. Didn't even know it till someone pointed it out to us. But after the Tove book was written, Laura, my daughter, and I, and Chris, 3 to 5 times a week got letters from churches. People in churches abused by people in churches. You know, it's okay to read about Bill Hybels. But when it's 3 to 5 a week for 16 months, it's overwhelming. There's a lot of trauma in churches today, a lot of trauma. And a lot of this trauma comes from church conflict, conflict about stuff that we'd rather not talk about at times. And I've written another book with a student, Pastor Tommy Phillips, that has the title Invisible Jesus, with a catchy clickbait subtitle, Leaving the Church and Looking for Christ. Tommy is a musician and a pastor who has spent the last 10 years or more dealing with young leaders, people in the church, who are deconstructing their faith. And he has been irritated beyond irritation by the way some apologists have talked about what deconstructors are actually doing, because he knows them. And I know them because a lot of them are my students who are pastors, who are also going through this process of deconstruction. And they're troubled by things in the church, and they have been theologically and intellectually and existentially traumatized by the church, by rigid ideas. And I'm frequently asked, what are these major ideas? So I'm going to give them to you. The status and treatment of women traumatizes women in the church and spouses of women who are gifted to lead and to teach and to preach and to elder and deacon and pastor. Political partisanship in the church is causing people to deconstruct their faith. They're sick and tired of a church that aligns with a single political party. I know that goes both ways, and a lot of people like to say it goes both ways, but I think we also know what this really means. Hypocrisy in the church is deeply troubling to some of these people, and they're going through it, and you as leaders are looking at these people who are questioning the church. Sexual identity issues. You know, I really don't care what you believe about this, because I care about people who are troubled by this as an issue in the church. And of course, I can go through the Bible. I've written about this, all right? Chapter 12, I believe, in A Fellowship of Difference, ENTS, not ENCE. It's a difficult issue in the Bible, but it is an existential issue for many young people who are wondering about the viability of the church. Social justice indifference, wages, what people make, housing, racism, ecology. These things matter to a lot of people in the United States. And these people show up in your churches and they want to hear a word about God, from God, about these issues. And if you are indifferent to these issues, it's easy to say we're not going to talk about politics, but there aren't very many pages in the Bible that aren't about politics. Amen. Have you read the law? What's that law about, you know? Is that about personal spirituality with Richard Foster? You can go hide in a mountain and pray? No. This is about justice in society. And the prophets, you know, they can get pretty wrapped up about this stuff. Justice. Jesus, his first sermon in Nazareth was hardly unpolitical. The Lord has anointed me to proclaim liberty for the poor. All right. And to release the captives. This is language from Isaiah 61 that is talking about what we would call politics. Now, maybe you can find not as much politics in Paul until you get to Romans 13. But you can't read the book of Revelation and not read about politics. That's Rome written large. And it is a powerful piece of castigation and political rhetoric about political corruption. So we can say we don't want to talk about politics, but we will not be faithful. And people want to hear a word from God about how to live as Christians in our society. There are rigid views of inerrancy and literal readings of the Bible that trouble young people who are questioning the Christian faith, and it leads them to deconstruction. Do we care about these things? Now, I might get in trouble with this one, but John said I'm a wild man, so I can, and I leave Saturday, so, you know, here we go. We'll be back. Dispensational kitsch. All right, this is not just a word about dispensationalism, though I could say words about that, but I'll avoid that. It has to do with something like anything Netanyahu says is right because he's in Israel. This is disturbing to me. And everything about the Palestinians is wrong because they're connected to Hamas. That's disturbing. This is a massive injustice in the Holy Land. And I'm not just bothered because now I can't take students to Israel. I'm bothered because we are so insensitive to the moral issues at work in that society, and that we think we can cover it with the Scofield Bible. We can't. We are not exempted. And a lot of people are bothered by this. Creation science. I taught undergraduates for 17 years. And students who are scientists, who go into biology, they listen to creation science and they think these people are hokey. They think, what world do they live in? And I've had students in tears in my office say, if I have to believe that, I can't believe in the Bible. The Bible has to be wrong if that's what they're talking about. How do we explore these issues with people in our churches? And I think another major issue is the church's performance. Sunday morning is a performance. You know, I talk about pastors a lot, and I talk to pastors a lot. They're my favorite people. Sometimes. But these platforms are designed for performers. Performing is not pastoring. You know, I could be a pretty good speaker, I think, at times. And some of you are probably pretty good yourself. But that's not pastoring. Amazing sermons on Sunday morning is not pastoring. That's what Eugene Peterson griped about for 50 years. Is that pastors are spiritual mentors to people. And that's different than performative sermons with amazing bands. It really is different. And some people think, is really that what church is? Amazing performance on Sunday morning? What about the other, you know, you subtract 1 hour from the week now. Maybe if it's a long-winded preacher, 2 hours. And the rest of the week, what's that about? And they want to know about this. And I realize that you're facing these people all the time. And that's why Tommy and I wrote this book, Invisible Jesus. And one of our editors said this, and we stole the expression and didn't give him credit for it. Editors get enough credit as it is. All their behind-the-scenes manipulations, you know. But he said, this is the exit interview that churches never give. And I think he's right. So we used that expression a few times. But I tell everyone we got it from the editor. And we took credit. So pastors are also traumatized people. And I would say that a lot of you are traumatized. And there are a lot of people in your church who are traumatized. So I want to read to you a story of one of my students who is a pastor, and he's a graduate now. And he is extraordinarily gifted with all the skill set, and he's socially gifted with his social skills, and he's a spiritual man, and he took a pastorate. I won't tell you where, but he went through hell in his church with the congregants. You know, I've criticized pastors in Tove. It's time to criticize congregants too, because I'm with you. But don't tell anybody I'm doing this, okay? But that's what this trauma book will be about. The trauma works both ways. Here's his story. The streetlight, it's a little bit long, but he's a good writer. The streetlight glared pale through my window. I couldn't sleep. I looked at the clock. 2:30 a.m. That's rare for him, but it's not for me. I'm over 70. 2:30 is a good night's sleep. How could my heart be racing? Groping for my neck, I took my pulse. 110 beats per minute. My wife rolled over and whispered, "Are you okay?" I responded, "Yeah, we were both lying." My mind could not stop. How did I end up here? What did I do wrong? How could my church hate me this much? I performed the pastoral math. I officiated weddings. I attended funerals. I volunteered with the kids' ministry. The church was growing. New staff were being hired. I did exactly what we agreed in my job description. Yet days prior, I was called into an unsanctioned electronic church meeting convened by a board who had no purview over the senior pastor. Anxious, I logged on. As the room populated, I found the room full of people, the majority of whom were special invites. These were the most prominent families in my church. I had just entered my own trial. Fight, flight, or freeze. He knows the language of trauma. I froze. Over the next 2 hours, they aired their grievances, often Christianizing their language for the sake of legitimacy. I didn't diminish my personal weaknesses, but they refused to understand them as anything other than moral deficiency, even going so far as to attack the character of my wife. In that meeting, the world slowed to a crawl. Was this really happening? Matthew 7:4 played through my mind. Could they be right? In an instant, I replayed every interaction for the previous 2 years. I could not find anything to justify their accusations. Was there a log in my own eye that I could not see? Self-doubt set in. Perhaps I was the person they said I was. No, these are all signs of trauma. Was the church worse because of me? I did the spiritual calculus again. Church attendance was up. Discipleship was growing. Worship seemed more spiritual. The budget was growing. I was giving my time sacrificially. I openly loved this church. Could they not see it? Why would they treat my family with such disdain? I was certain there had to be a reasonable explanation. What did I do wrong? I stopped that thought process. Only 5 minutes had passed. It was 2:45 a.m. My mind stopped replaying the past and turned toward the future. Hypervigilance must be the only way toward stability. I began to calculate every possible scenario. I assumed that if I could control all the variables, then they would stop attacking me. I played it out. If they say this, then I'll respond like that. If someone attacks my wife's character, this is how I'll emotionally calm myself and respond with gentleness. My wife looked at me again. "Are you all right?" My blank stare was all the answer she needed. My body felt ill. How could emotional anxiety have such dramatic effects in my body? Sleep was a stranger. I was on autopilot. A few days later, I received a text. "Check your email." One of the most respected leaders sent a public email to the entire church defaming my character and my pastoral competency. He even placed my wife in his crosshair. Reply all can be cruel. People began to pile on. Time seemed to stop. I froze again, lost in my own thoughts. How can I lovingly pastor this church? I checked my pulse. My heart was racing, but it couldn't keep pace with my mind. Where did I go wrong? What did I do? Why can't I make sense of this? At my breaking point, I went to the chair of my elder board for support. I did my best to explain. My wife was in tears every Sunday morning. She dreaded going to church, but she feared being judged for not going to church even more. I was having panic attacks. I needed space. So I asked for a month off to seek therapy with my family. He agreed, so long as I promised to return every Sunday morning to deliver the sermon. Oh, he didn't want church leadership to show signs of weakness. Not knowing how to respond, I agreed. Finally, we got reprieve. With little energy left to sustain my facade, the depth of my exhaustion and woundedness was laid bare in therapy. My mind still couldn't comprehend how I got here. Where did I go wrong? The past held no answers, and the future was murky with fear. Should I even be a pastor? Reluctantly, I came to realize that my pastoral heart and my financial needs were being leveraged against me. Pastors don't always hold power in a church. My church held extraordinary leverage over me. They validated my pastoral calling. They set my salary. They owned my home. They were dominant share of my family's social network. When church turned bad, no wonder I was overcome with the need to control every possible scenario and prevent their next attack. It was here where my therapist told me that my mental process mirrored that of an abused spouse. I placed responsibility on myself for the free choices that someone else was making to attack me. The house would never be clean enough. The meals would never be good enough. The children would never be well-behaved enough. No amount of perfection would ever be enough. And so the blows kept on coming. Was it really not my fault? After several months of therapy and prayer, I built the courage to resign. My biggest fear was still disappointing them. Their critiques had a lasting effect. Perhaps I wasn't strong enough or spiritual enough to be a pastor. Discerning the spirits is a gift for a reason. I never saw the ways in which my honest affections for the church could be used against me. I never saw my propensity toward self-blame. I never saw my need for friends who could see from the outside what I could not see from the inside. I could not guard my heart by myself, and I am grateful for all those who walked with me and helped me fight the battles I could not fight on my own. On the other side, I'm still recovering 2 years later, and I can graciously accept that I will never be a perfect pastor. Yet in his mercy, Jesus has qualified me. I'm grateful to Christ for sustaining my family and my vocational call to serve an abusive church. I'm an emblem of Jesus' body, which is capable of deep goodness and redemption. That's your world. Many of you are right there today, right? I've got good news for you. The good news is not it's going away. The good news is, amazingly, Paul went through this too. You may not like the guy, but he's been through all you've been through and more. And we're going to get there today. We'll get to the Bible. But I want you to understand, this is the world that a lot of us understand is the pastoral world. Blameless is a great word until you're being traumatized. And then you need a different word. Amy's given you one word. I'll give you some other words. It's hard. What you're doing is extremely difficult. And you will never be satisfied. Because church people will never be satisfied. It's the way it is. and you're called to serve them and to pastor them and to love them even when they don't love you. And that will be frequent. But Jesus has been there. Paul's been there. And we're going to talk about that. Okay? All right. Pastors are considering leaving the church in significant numbers today. In 2023, a survey in the autumn of 2023 called Exploring the Pandemic Impact on Congregations indicated more than 40% of clergy had seriously pondered leaving the ministry since 2020. That's a lot. More than half considered leaving the pastoral ministry entirely. Half of those, 40%. More telling is that 13% of pastors think about resigning often. Yet, the study concluded that human wellness indicators could easily suggest pastors are reasonably healthy. So when they study their health, their mental health, they're doing pretty well. All right. There are other significant factors which relate to both to thoughts of leaving and wellness, I'm quoting. Therefore, one must look elsewhere to understand the dynamics of why increased numbers of religious leaders are considering departing. For a clearer picture, we need to examine the changing contextual reality within the nation's faith communities. Other realities then are shaping this difficulty in pastoring, and I'm sure that 40% of the people sitting in this room have thought about jumping off the path. You're pretty normal. Decline in attendance is a significant issue. Incline in the age of congregants. A growing resistance to any more post-pandemic changes in how churches operate. You know, the pivoting that took place during COVID was too much for a lot of people. It's just not the same taking the Lord's Supper on Zoom, is it? And some churches won't even do that. Bless their hearts. That's not a compliment. That's Southern. I know this is Portland, but there's people from the South up here too. Amy said y'all. All right. I mean, that was really Southern. A decline in volunteers is occurring. More than a third of churches believe their church future is uncertain. Add to this a new study concluding that what pastors and churches do, that is, church itself, is waning in importance. I remember the days, I'm old enough to remember, when pastors were persons of respect in the community. And it was cool. It was Gilead by Marilyn Robinson, you know. It was fun to read about. It's Willa Cather stuff, if you've read her novels. Nearly 80% of Americans contend that religion is losing or has lost its influence in public life. They're right. And the number is getting worse. And yet, almost 60% of people believe that religion has a positive impact on society. On that, we can stand and say, have some encouragement. But the same Pew study finds that they know, too, that their faith puts them at odds with American culture. Pastors are noticeably more willing to adapt to new conditions more than congregants. And I think you all know this. I remember, I don't think it was John Rosenstiel, but it was in his class, that someone said, you know how you move a piano from one side of the platform to the other? 1 inch a month. And no one will notice. You try 6 feet in 1 week and you probably will get some emails. But one of the biggest issues facing pastors today is church conflict, and it is traumatizing for pastors. So what is fascinating to me is that the calling of pastors, what you feel most called to do, and the expectations of churches, congregants, are not the same thing. How did we get out of line in this way? Here's what pastors like to do. They like to walk with people during their spiritual journey and commitment to God. They like that. They like to have positive relationships with congregants. They like to be able to call their church family. They like worshiping and fellowshipping with one another, singing together, Sunday worship. They like to participate in outreach activities with one another. They know there's food insecurity and there's issues about poverty, and they like to participate in these things. They like to teach Christian education and program, especially for youth and young adults. Pastors generally like to preach. Sermon preparation and Bible study matters to them. Seeing the church grow, particularly through children and youth participation, and seeing intergenerational churches. But this isn't always what pastors get to do. There's meetings and technology problems and Zoom problems. And at the end of the week, you wonder where your week went. And the calling of a pastor, of mentoring people spiritually, and the expectation of congregations are not always in line. So conflict arises. Now, I don't know what time I'm supposed to be done, but I see a clock back there. Is there anybody in charge? John, what time am I supposed to be done?
Get about 20 minutes.
Okay. So I want to commend you today, because from the looks of it, you're sticking it out. I can see lots of reasons why you would want to do something else. I'm a professor. If I put up with what you put up with, I wouldn't put up with what you put up with. You know, it's just not worth it to me. I have to have tranquility to be able to think and write. If people are arguing with me all day long and sending me nasty emails, it works you up, you know. The whole week you get worked up about one nasty email. Some of you dread the inbox. And I just want to commend you for what you're doing. And I want to encourage you to focus in your church on church culture. And I was asked to talk a little bit about Tove and Pivot, so I'll pivot to those terms now. For a few minutes to finish off. I think that we can map toxicity in churches. And when our family was connected to Willow Creek and Bill Hybels, not to Bill Hybels personally. I mean, I shook his hand. But we were connected to that church. And when the story broke, I read it in we were sitting in our room. Chris and I were sitting there in the evening, and I read it in the Chicago Tribune. And I said, Chris, this is unbelievable. This is a story about Bill Hybels and Willow Creek, and this is bad news, and it's true. Because of the witnesses that they pulled in, Nancy Beach, Fonda Dyer, these are people who are not going to be not telling the truth. So we contacted my daughter and her husband, Mark, who had been engaged at Willow Creek for a long time, and Mark had served in one of the ministries at the church. And it started out a journey that changed the lives and directions of both Laura and me, as well as Chris and our families. And a couple months later, I think it was in March, I wrote a blog post about Willow Creek, and I defended the victims. And you could say it was the best of worlds and it was the worst of worlds at the same time. Laura lost a lot of friends at the church. My blog post went viral at Willow Creek. They talked about it for a week. And a publisher asked me to write a book about Willow Creek. And I said, no, I'm not a church historian. I'm not an evangelical historian. I have opinions, but I'm not a historian of that. And they're never going to give me access to the records that I would need. Well, my daughter was a pest. And she kept asking me to write some more about Willow Creek. And then the story in the New York Times broke, and that was the story. It was all over. Everybody knew the story was true. And I didn't tell Laura anything other than, no, I don't have time for this. I'm writing a book on Revelation, which, of course, is a lot more important. If I have to deal with dispensational kitsch, I'll do it in my own way. So, I was reading a book about German pastors' response to the Holocaust and to Hitler. It's called A Church Divided by Matthew Hockenoss. And as I was reading this, I began to notice something and started to take notes, and I thought, this is really weird. What the German pastors did in refusing to take any responsibility for complicity for the church under the age of Hitler, which you might know enough about, called the German church, the Deutsche Christen, and their complete denial of the gospel and the Jewishness of Jesus. And one of my favorite New Testament scholars at one time was Walter Gruntmann, who wrote a book asking the question, was Jesus really a Jew? Now, only Germans ask questions like that at that time of life in history. And I began to notice that the pastor's response and refusal to take responsibility paralleled what was going on at Willow Creek, paralleled what was going on with Southern Baptist pastors in the United States, and paralleled what goes on in the Roman Catholic priesthood. And I thought, my goodness, there are all kinds of false narratives that churches are willing to tell in order to protect themselves and to avoid confessing their sins. I mean, come on, think about it. That's what churches are here for, to help people confess their sin and find forgiveness and grace in Jesus Christ. And here these leaders are refusing to admit their sins. So I began to take notes, and I had a list of seven parallels between church leaders in the United States and church leaders in Germany following World War II. And I kept it to myself. And at Christmas break with Laura and Mark, I leaked it accidentally, and it led to a book, all right? A Church Called Tove. And The Church Called Tove started mapping marks of toxicity in church leaders. And here's what we found. These are the very noticeable marks. Narcissistic leaders. Platforms like this in big churches attract personalities that like platforms. All right. We just have to deal with this. All right. Find people who don't belong on the platform. They're the best people for the platform. Fear of the leader. Toxic leaders produce people around them who they surround themselves with people who fear them and fear their disapproval. And they live on a knife's edge of nearly saying the wrong thing. Institution creep. So that the institution matters so much that people are willing to compromise their principles and corrupt their morality to save the reputation of the institution and church. False narratives. We call it spin. Instead of telling the truth, they can spin the story. You know, or they can flip the story. Loyalty is a primary characteristic of toxic leaders. And they know who is loyal and who's not. And if you offer a criticism, you can be squashed like a bug. And even if it's not offered as a criticism, but an observation, It's heard that way. Narcissistic leaders have fragile egos. And they live in a world fearing shame, but they live in shame. Celebrity. They like to be celebrities. I know, you know, this is my criticism, so if it applies to you, I'm sorry. I still have it. I don't think pastors ought to be that separated from their people. If you have to go through six layers to get to the pastor, that person's not your pastor. And that person's probably not a pastor. Celebrities are that way. Celebrities are performing stage personas rather than pastoral personalities. That was a lot of P's. It was the first time I ever said that, so I didn't know where it was going. Pastors, pastor people, you know. I have students who'll say, do you think I should be a pastor? You know what I ask them? Are you pastoring anyone? It's not a job. It's something you are called to do, and you cannot not do it. I take students on foreign trips. You know what it's like to take 25 pastors on a bus? They all care too much for too many people. Everybody's got a problem they all want to talk to and deal with them. That's what pastors do. You know, if they don't do that, they become professors. Just ask Amy. She told the truth there. So these are, they produce, this is a pet peeve of mine, is we have a leadership culture rather than a pastoral or shepherd culture. There is a difference. I know that pastors lead. But the idea of pastoring is not derived from the business world. You might learn some things there. But pastors are, they learn their trade by watching Jesus, learn a little bit from Paul. He's not bad. Sometimes he gets a bit off base. Peter seems to be pretty decent. But boy, Ezekiel knows the stuff. You just read his critique of bad shepherds and you've got a pastoral theology course. And so I think we need to foster pastor cultures rather than leadership cultures. All right. That's not exactly overwhelming. Okay, thank you. So we flipped the script. We saw these characteristics: narcissism, fear, institution creep, false narratives, loyalty, celebrity, and leadership. And we flipped the script. We didn't find these in the fruit of the Spirit. We flipped the script and said, what is to be replaced? What should it be? And here's what are characteristics of tov, the Hebrew word for good or goodness. Instead of a toxic culture, a tov culture. Empathy. You know, a narcissist has no empathy for anyone. Just watch them. You can see them on TV. Pastors have empathy. They feel it with other people. They administer grace. If someone makes a mistake on the platform on Sunday morning in the band, they don't fire them that day and humiliate them in front of their friends and team members. They ask the question, how can I help this person develop the skill that is needed for that position? What can I do to help them? And they administer grace and forgiveness and help. They put people first. Good pastors know people's names. They know people's stories. And they know their children's names and their some of their children's stories. Because they're storified people. That's what pastors do. They know you and your story. They know your name. They tell the truth. A tov culture tells the truth. Now, I don't think that you have to humiliate people when you tell them that, when you tell the congregation that someone is no longer employed. But I also think you shouldn't bend the truth. You should tell the truth. That sometimes leaders fail so miserably they can no longer be respected in the church. And sometimes their failures are criminal. And we have had to report something to the police. And so-and-so is no longer working with us. That's the truth. You know, the church never benefits from spinning stories. Amen. It never benefits when we refuse to tell the truth about what's going on. Maybe for the moment, the reputation is saved. But the deconstructors will figure it out. And they'll call you to count. Tov cultures not only put people first, they tell the truth. And they pursue justice. They don't pursue loyalty. They do what's right. And I often say justice is doing the right thing at the right time. Doing the right thing too late is the right thing. But because it was too late, it didn't do the redemptive work that it could have done. And maybe that redemptive work will eventually work out. Do the right thing at the right time. And you know, as leaders, it's often very difficult to know what the right thing to do at the right moment is. It's really hard. But never be afraid of doing the right thing. So we pursue, Tov pursues justice. It produces a culture of service. I tell my pastor students that they should be involved in some kind of compassion ministry in their community. And you know, they say, yeah, it's a good idea. And then I say this, don't ever tell anybody other than your spouse, and don't ever use it in a sermon illustration. And you'll begin to experience what real service is. Because if you're getting congratulated for working in a homeless kitchen, you're getting congratulated, not doing the service. So don't tell anybody, but be involved in the community. I know a pastor who for 2 years served in a homeless kitchen and didn't tell anybody in the church. And he said it was one of the most redemptive things he had ever done in his life. He said nobody even knew at the kitchen who I was. And I thought I was somebody until I just became a dishwasher. And we should pursue, instead of leadership, we should pursue Christ-likeness. I like to say we should pursue followership. We should convey a culture in our churches that people come and they're going to see what it means to be like Christ. Amen. That they will not praise us, that they will come to church to encounter Jesus and to see him. And when they walk away, they don't say, that was a great sermon. They say, I saw the face of Jesus today. There's a big difference, you know. Some preachers are really good at this and some aren't. And we need to work on this. So I think we can map Tov and toxicity. And I have a couple minutes here. I'd like to talk about pivot in this way. To produce Tov cultures in churches, we're going to have to pivot. Now, I didn't know about the scene on one of those shows. I don't even know what the name of the show is. Maybe it's Friends. Friends? I didn't even know what the pivot scene was. But my daughter told me I was totally out of touch and irrelevant. And I should know. And I said, well, nobody will know about that. And she said, Dad, everybody knows about this. So I posted on my Twitter and it got like 20,000 views. I won't tell you what my normal posts get. All right. It's going to take time. It's going to take time to build a culture of Tov. It's not about a sermon series. As long as it took to build the culture that's in your church, it will take to undo the culture in your church. It takes years. And the standard line, I'm not kidding you, this comes from the business world, but I think it's right. The standard line is it takes 7 years to transform a culture of an institution when everybody's committed to transforming the culture. Now, getting a whole church committed to transforming as a church culture has a zero chance unless you're Roger Williams, who is a Baptist pastor of a church of one. He could not get along with anybody, and eventually he had his own church, and it was himself. He wasn't even sure about his wife after a while. And you might know that he's the founder of the Baptists. Well, just so you might know American history. Roger Williams. Look him up. Google him. But wait a minute. Three priorities that we need to develop. Three priorities. Tov character. It's about character, not competence. Mr. Rogers is always a nice guy because of his character. Surround yourself with Tov characters. Find people to hang out with who are Tov. They'll make you Tover. That's a Hebrew word with an English ending. Practice Tov power. This is really difficult. Power is an issue. Big issue. Character is an issue. Power is an issue. Practice Tov power. Tov power serves others rather than aggrandizes it for itself. And find Tov examples to talk about. Now, in our Tov book, my daughter would find these stories and I'd say, I don't know, we might find out something else about this person. And lo and behold, we did. So the rule for Pivot was they had to be dead. And so we used Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers, I don't know of any bad stories about the guy who wanted to kill him, really destroy him and his reputation, interviewed him and said, the man on TV is the man of reality. So Mr. Rogers is fine as a good Tov example. But it's disappointing to use someone as example and then look at him in your book and you go, whoa, that was not a good choice. All right, so find Tov examples. Now, three priorities, three practices. Form Tov coalitions. That is, get some people together who have an understanding of Tov. And even to figure out what Tov is for your church is going to take work together. Studying the Bible independently and coming together and saying, these are the things we need to focus on. So you build a coalition of people. You take one step at a time. You can't preach Tov and the whole church transforms. Now that happens in hyper-Pentecostal congregations for a good couple hours. And then they go back to where they were. It takes a long time for this to happen. All right. So you're going to have to do one step at a time and say, you know, we are not good at meeting new people who come into our church who are not like us. So we're going to take steps to work on this for the next year. And at the end of the year, we're going to give a brutal assessment of ourselves. And if we're not good enough on it, we're going to keep working on it until we get this figured out. Usually one can be the vanguard of transformation. And create pockets of Tov in your church. A coalition, one step at a time, and create pockets. Finally, there are three powers that are involved in all Tov cultures. The first is we have to recognize the power of a congregation's culture. Because of my privilege of getting to travel around the world and travel around the United States and speak in different places, I've been in a lot of churches, and you can feel a church culture within hours of a place. Congregations can draw people to Jesus, and congregations can lead people to deconstruct and look for Jesus somewhere else because he was invisible there. Second, rely on the Holy Spirit. I believe in the Holy Spirit, third person of the Trinity. Without the Spirit, this stuff doesn't happen. With the Spirit, revival can occur. But don't expect it to change everything all at once. That's not the way it works. And finally, to echo the words of Amy in the previous talk, we have to depend on grace. We need to realize it's not us. It's the work of God in our midst, in the power of the Spirit that exalts the Lord Jesus Christ, not us. So we don't glorify our bands. We don't glorify our preachers. We don't glorify how much great work we've done. We talk about Jesus, and we want people to talk and hear about Jesus.
Thanks for listening to the Together PDX podcast. I've got great news. We have more for you from Dr. Scott McKnight. The second part of this talk is available right now. And for all recordings of our past gospel gatherings, you can visit our website, togetherpdx.org/podcast.